crowd, and especially with the elements. I'm glad that you braved it and came on tonight. We know that a Bible study is your priority, that worshiping God ranks high on your list of things that you enjoy doing. And, of course, worshiping with God's people is a duty, but we also find it a great pleasure and a joy. And so we are willing to invest a lot into it, and we're willing to even sacrifice to be here. We're thankful for everyone who is here. The first example of someone who received a benefits check from the Social Security Administration was named Ida Mae Fuller. And she was from Ludlow, Vermont. And she received her Social Security check of an amount of $22.54. And that was in 1940. She retired as a legal secretary in 1939, in November. And then she received her first check in 1940. She was 65 when she retired, but she lived another 35 years. She died when she was 100. And over the course of time, even though she had only invested about $25 into the Social Security account, she was given benefits of about $23,000. And so that was quite a lot more than she actually invested. But that was all right because, of course, so many people were paying into Social Security that if one person got a lot more out of Social Security than the people than she had invested, then the money that the other people had put into the account would well take care of her. Of course, at that time, there were a whole lot more people paying into it than were receiving benefits from it. In the year 1945, there were about 42 workers paying into Social Security for every one beneficiary of Social Security. But that has changed. In fact, in 20 years, that ratio went from 42 to 1 to 4 to 1. And now we're at about 3 to 1. And people are saying that by the year 2030, it will be about 2 to 1. And some people speculate that Social Security will just go out of existence. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm not an economist, and that's not what I'm speaking on tonight. But I just bring that up as a way to say that people have seen that it's important to try to make some effort as a community to take care of those who are older and have trouble accessing this world's goods. And God has a Social Security system. But it's a whole lot more simple than the American government's Social Security system. And that is basically that God says, take care of grandma. And he says, take care of your aged mother. And he just basically puts a responsibility on people to take care of their own folks. And we're going to see that as we study what the Bible has to say on this matter tonight. And I think if I could just summarize the whole lesson into one phrase, I would say that when you look into God's heart, you find a great concern for widows. You find a great concern also for widowers as well, and you find a great concern for everyone who struggles to access this world's goods. God has always been concerned about his people taking care of the less fortunate. In fact, in Matthew chapter 25, when Jesus gave his portrayal of the judgment day, and I suppose all of our children could answer if we said, where can you read about the judgment day? They would say, Matthew 25. And that's right, Jesus gave his account of what the day of judgment will be like. And his account is the only one that really matters because he's going to be the judge on that day. We will all give account before the judgment seat of Christ for the things that we've done in our bodies, 2 Corinthians 5:10. So Jesus will be the judge and we will be the judged. And on that occasion, he will pronounce a judgment largely based upon how we took care of people in need. I mean, we'll be judged based on every word that he spoke. We'll be judged based on every part of the Bible that's applicable to us, John chapter 12 and verse 48. And yet, the part of the basis on which we will be judged that Christ talked about in Matthew 25 was, how did you treat the least of these, my brethren? How did you treat those who needed your help? In particular, how did you treat those people who were Christians who needed your help? And so Christians are all concerned about taking care of those who are struggling, those who may be in need, and particularly the widows. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10 says, do good unto all men, and especially those of the household of faith. So first, I'd like for us to observe what God said on this matter in the Old Testament. Now, I know we're not under the Old Testament. We don't operate under its legal system, and yet, you can see how important it was in God's mind for us to take care of widows, even in the way his heart addressed that matter in the Old Testament. And then We will shift gears just a few minutes after that, and we will think about what did God say on the matter of care for widows in the New Testament. And then finally, we will observe that in the New Testament age, there were some widows who were to be fully supported by the church. Fully supported by the church. And we'll see that passage in 1 Timothy 5 in just a few minutes. But let's observe, first of all, what the Old Testament says on this matter. And again, when we talk about widows, we're not singling them out as the only group that may need help at some times. Other people may need help. But I think the Bible focuses on them especially because the husband usually dies first, and also because it's often the case that a widow might be particularly susceptible to hard times later on in her life as she gets a little bit older and a little bit less able to take care of herself. Now let's look at Exodus 22, beginning in verse 22. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. You see how seriously God takes the treatment of widows. Now look at Deuteronomy 24, beginning in verse 17. You shall not pervert the justice due to the sojourner or to the fatherless, that is, the orphan, or take a widow's garment in pledge. That is, you shouldn't take her garment as collateral on a loan. Don't be taking something that she needs as collateral on a loan. Don't take a widow's garment in pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. In other words, God says, don't be too careful about making sure that you get every sheaf in your wheat field, because that would just leave a little bit of that extra for the fatherless. And if you happen to drop some, just leave it for a widow or a fatherless person or a sojourner, somebody who's passing through. Leave it for them to gather. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over them again. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not strip it afterward. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. Now look at Deuteronomy 5. I know it may be annoying to be read to a little bit, but I just want you to see how often God spoke about this, how serious it was in God's mind. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. You're about to read the Levirat law. You've heard of that before? The Levirat law of marriage in the Old Testament. Levirat, L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E. That word just comes from a Latin word that means brother's wife. And so this is the law about what a brother does when his brother's wife dies. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. Okay, so here is a way that the brother's name would not be blotted out from Israel, but it also included the care of that widow. It was a law that protected widows. Now look at verses 7 through 10. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. She shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. Now to us, having one sandal pulled off doesn't signify any great shame. But apparently in that time and culture, if you were one who had had his sandal pulled off and had that widow, your sister-in-law, to spit in your face, then that was a sign of great dishonor. Why? Because you did not fulfill a role that was expected, and it was a role that involved taking care of your own and taking care of your sister-in-law, taking care that her husband's, your brother's name, would be perpetuated in Israel. Okay, there is a brief summary of what the Old Testament says on the matter of taking care of the widows. Now, let's shift gears and look at what the New Testament says. And I don't think you're going to be surprised at all that the Bible says an awful lot in the New Testament about caring for them as well. For example, James chapter 1 and verse 27 says that true and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit who? To visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Pure and undefiled religion. If you were going to say, here is how we might describe the essence of pure religion, it would be: faithful Christians are ones who love their brethren so much that when their brethren are in trouble, they take care of those needs, when they have legitimate needs. And we think about Acts chapter 6 in this connection, don't we? Remember in Acts chapter 6 when the Grecian widows were neglected in the daily ministration? That is, those Greek-speaking or Greek-cultured widows in the church at Jerusalem were being neglected in the daily ministration. And that came to the apostles' attention, and the apostles wanted to take care of it post-haste. So they made sure that they got seven qualified men together to serve as deacons to take care of that, because they didn't want any needy brethren in the church at Jerusalem who had legitimate needs to go unsatisfied. They wanted everyone to have plenty of food to eat and to be well taken care of. And so the Bible says much about this. But in the writings of the Apostle Paul, we have some more specific information. It's not just that the New Testament says, okay, you Christians, take care of the widows. Now, that would probably be enough to get us started. But the Apostle Paul gave us additional information that will help us do it more effectively. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, we read about how the church is supposed to take care of this particular demographic within the body. And so let's read what the Apostle Paul had to say about it, beginning in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 4. Now here we find that the first defense against widows suffering in affliction is the widow's own family. That is, first of all, the widow's own family ought to take care of the widow's needs. Look at verse 4. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn. That literally means learn by putting into practice. That is, learn by doing. And sometimes we just have to learn to do something, even if it's something we don't like. I remember my mother, when I was little, she would want me to try Brussels sprouts, or she would want me to try greens or something it was I didn't like. And I would say, I don't like that. That wasn't a good answer, was it, Mr. Clay? That just never worked. I could say I don't like it all day long, but you know what my mother would say? She would say, learn to like it. Or she would say, if you'll eat this, you'll learn to like it. Well, some of those things I learned to like, and I'm not sure I learned to like all those things. But when God says, learn by putting into practice, that means go ahead and try to do this. Even if you're not so sure you want to do it, go ahead and learn to do it. And here, 1 Timothy 5, 4, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. Now, pause on that phrase, return to their parents. What on earth does that mean? That means that parents have invested so much in children, and then when children grow up, they should return on that investment to their parents, or that they owe a debt to their parents. Now, we understand the principle of debts. I suppose everyone in here has some form of debt or another. I know that I pay a number of bills every month, and I've got to make sure I satisfy those debts. Have you considered the debt that you might owe to your parents, or the debt that you might owe to your grandparents? Who on earth has given you more than your parents or your grandparents? Surely there's nobody in most cases. Now, there are some exceptions, but in general, parents and grandparents have given so much of themselves to us, have given so much money in terms of care for us. When Becca and I were doing premarital counseling, the counselor said, are children planned? And we talked about how we anticipate having children one day, and he said, well, that's very good, but I want to tell you how much it costs to have children. And he proceeded to give us some statistics about that. That was one of those moments, and there were a number of these moments in premarital counseling, but that was one of those moments when your eyes just open wide, and you say, wow, I did not realize what my parents invested in me when I was a child. Of course, my first thought is, What about my paying, you know, for children in the future? But then my second thought is, my parents sacrificed an awful lot in order to rear me. And I need to bear that in mind, especially as I interact with my parents in the future. I need to recognize that they have sacrificed for me. And there is a debt owed on that occasion. And couldn't we, in many cases, do better than we do about attending to our parents? Maybe our parents aren't afflicted particularly yet. Maybe they're not ill. Maybe they're not to the point where they can't care for themselves very well anymore. But couldn't we do better, especially when we're grown and we live away from our parents, to stay in touch with our parents, to call them on the telephone and tell them we're thinking about them, to let them be a part of our lives, to let them hear our voice? I think it would be a very good practice if we would make sure that our parents get to hear our voice every week, that they get to see our face every month or every quarter, if it's possible for us to do that, to make sure that they know we care for them and that we want to stay plugged in to the affairs of their lives. Wouldn't that be a good thing, to make sure we're returning on the investment of our parents and not neglecting them, loving them and providing for them emotionally, if not also by taking care of their physical needs, recognizing all that they've done for us? I remember reading an article one time where a philosopher was talking about what grown children owe to their parents. And now, he was not a Christian. He was not arguing based on what the Bible says. But he made a very interesting observation. He said, grown children owe their parents special goods that nobody else can give to them. Now, think about this. Some goods other people could give to our parents. For example, what if our parents needed transportation to the hospital? Well, that could be arranged without us personally driving them to the hospital. Maybe they could take a taxi cab, or maybe they could take a bus, or maybe they have a neighbor who could take them to the hospital. We might like to take them, but other people could do that. What about someone feeding their cat? Or what about someone taking care of their yard? What about someone dealing with a variety of their physical needs? Someone else could do that. That could be provided. But there are some things that only a child or only a grandchild can provide to parents or grandparents. There is nobody else in the world who shares the memories and experiences that you share with your parents, or that you as a grandchild share with your grandparents. Who does a parent want to have around the dinner table at Thanksgiving? Is it the person who gives them their transportation to the hospital? Is it the person who comes over and works on their yard every now and then? Now, those are services you might provide, but also somebody else could provide. They only want the children and their families. They only want the grandchildren and their families, because there are special goods that they share, and nobody else can provide those special goods that a child or a grandchild can provide. So why don't we all make sure that we provide those goods too? Our ancestors, as best we can. We owe a special debt of gratitude. Well, the first thing that Paul says is the line of defense, the first line of defense against a parent or a grandparent suffering in old age is their own family. Not the church, but their own family. That's verse 4. Now, I want to move on to verse 8. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Now, isn't that strong language? Here is someone who has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Worse than an unbeliever. That shows that not all sins are equal before God. Now, there are some sins, all sins have some things in common. They're all against God. They're all violations of God's law, 1 John 3:4. Every sin that we may commit will send us to hell if it's not forgiven, Romans 6:23. Every sin can be forgiven by God, 1 John 1:9. Here are things that sins share. But in the mind of God, some sins are more grievous than others. And here's one that is on the more grievous side. Proverbs 6, verses 16 and 17 list sins that are on the more grievous side. One is a lying tongue. It begins by saying, six things does God hate. Yes, seven are an abomination. That is, here are things that are especially grievous to God. Hands that shed innocent blood are listed there. One who sows discord among brethren. I can't imagine going to the judgment day and having God look at me and say to me, you caused problems in the church. You sowed discord among the brethren. But neither do I want to get to the judgment day and have God look at me and say, you did not take care of your own. In my view, that is worse than being an infidel. We've got to take care of our own. We must provide especially for our own household. Now, let's move on. Look down to verse 16. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are truly widows. Now that phrase, truly widows, is very interesting. And I think the translation that was read for us a moment ago in your hearing had a good gloss on that or explained that a little bit better. But the idea of being truly a widow is a widow who is actually in need. We're not talking about the idea of there being some widows whose husbands have died and some widows whose husbands haven't died. That's not the point. We're talking about widows who are in need versus widows who are all right and have all of their needs taken care of. The church needs to be taking care of widows who are alone, who are having particular troubles, who are in affliction, who can't take care of themselves, and their families can't take care of them or won't take care of them either. But again, the first line of defense is that family. But now, let's move on to the next stage and observe this. Some widows are to be fully supported by the church. God commands that some widows are fully supported. Who are these widows? Well, they're the truly widows. They're the ones who are particularly in need. In verses 3 and 5, we find this. Verse 3 says, honor widows who are widows indeed, or who are truly widows. In verse 5 says, she who is truly a widow is one who is left all alone. So there's the category of people we're talking about. Now look at verses 5 and 6. It's a faithful Christian woman who is older. Faithful Christian woman who is older. She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. So here is a Christian woman who has been a faithful servant of God, and now she's in trouble. And the church takes care of her. And we're going to read on in just a few verses about how the church takes care of her fully. And you know, I've never seen this done in the United States. We don't know very much about it here because there are so many social programs and we're so well off in the United States that it rarely happens that a widow has to be fully supported by the church. But I know of a case where it has happened in India. And my father's been over there because the congregation where he preaches has a mission work in India. And he's gone over and seen where the church building is right next door to the church's house, a house that belongs to the church, and it is specifically for the widows who meet the qualifications that are mentioned in 1 Timothy 5. And the church gives them everything they need. Their food is taken care of. They have shelter. They have warmth. They are fully just enveloped in the care of the church because they don't have anywhere else to go. And of course, whenever a situation like that were to come up in our particular congregation, we would certainly do the same thing because God's concern that the poor and the struggling, and particularly the widows, be taken care of is so strong. Okay, now let's read on, beginning in verse 11. And here we're going to find that there are some who are to be refused in the enrollment. Oh, we need to do verses 9 and 10. I didn't read 9 and 10. Let a widow be enrolled, that is, counted in this number of people who are supported by the church fully. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, having a reputation for good works. Here is somebody who's obeyed the laws of the Bible, who has obeyed the Bible's laws about marriage also. If she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. Here is the kind of woman who, when we enroll her in this number, is going to represent the church well. Her character is so dependable that whenever people find out that the church is fully supporting her, their attitude will not be, how could the church support such a woman? Here is, they would never look at this woman and say, she has such bad character, why would the church be fully supporting her? Oh no, with this lady, when she is observed, they think, you know, isn't the church good to take care of such a fine, upstanding woman who has fallen on hard times? I think the church, I need to send people over to the Church of Christ because down there they really care about people who are in trouble. They have found this woman who is such a good woman. I've worked with her. I know her. I've hung out with her. She is such a fine, upstanding woman, and now I find she fell on hard times and the church has taken care of her. I'm thankful for them. You see, if a person has that kind of character, that will build a good name for the church in the community. And now, notice that there are some widows who are to be refused the enrollment. Look beginning in verse 11. But refuse to enroll younger women. For when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. That is, to marry wrong kinds of people and to fall into sin. Here are women who are going to be tempted to go into a profligate lifestyle because they're being fully supported and they don't have very many responsibilities. I suppose this could be mirrored somewhat by the welfare state in America, where there are many people who could work, they could make good use of their time, but because the government fully supports them or almost fully supports them, then they become lazy and they become just involved in a variety of sins because they don't take much responsibility for themselves. They desire to marry and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. For some have already strayed after Satan. Okay, so Paul says you only want to enroll those widows who are the truly widows, the ones who are widows indeed, who are actually in affliction and in need. And that's not going to include the younger women, because in general, the younger women are able to take some care for themselves. And of course, this doesn't rule out that we might partially care for a widow. This is talking about those widows who are enrolled, who are fully supported by the church. The church might well support a widow partially by giving her some support, even though she's not taken in to the number, or the number who are housed and fed and cared for by the church. And so here is a very careful pattern on the part of the Apostle Paul. But notice he doesn't give us a lot of details. How would this work? How should the church administrate this? How would the finances of such an operation work? Paul doesn't go into the details of that. But what would govern a situation like this? Christian love. If we really loved one another, and we do, when we want to take care of each other, the details of a program like this would work itself out. And why would we talk about a program like this here at Macklin Road if we don't have an immediate need for it? We talk about it because of this. We recognize that God's love is such that His family, His body, does not close up its heart from one another. Each member of the church loves each other member. The body is working together, fully functioning as the body of Christ, and that means every Christian looks after the needs of other Christians. And God's heart and the Christian's heart is always open and giving toward the brethren. And this is just a great example of it. Because this shows that when push comes to shove and people really are in need, the Christians take care of one another. And this is just a beautiful example in 1 Timothy 5 of how something like this would work. You've been very kind to listen, and I hope that throughout our lives we will exercise Christian benevolence. And then when the world sees the church, they will see what Jesus described in John chapter 13 and verse 34, when he said, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples." If what? If you love one another. Jesus did not say, "They will know you're my disciples if you teach all the right doctrine." Now, doctrine's important. We must not compromise one word of doctrine. We must never compromise anything the Bible teaches. But at the same time, Jesus said, "They will know you're my disciples if you love one another." So each of us must look inwardly, must do an internal examination. That's what 2 Corinthians 13, 5 says. It says, "Test yourselves," or "examine yourselves and see if you're in the faith." So each of us must do an internal investigation and say, "Am I exercising Christian love faithfully to my brethren? Am I showing them how much I care for them?" I trust that we are. But if you haven't been and you need to be restored to faithfulness, then we can certainly help you with that tonight. Or maybe someone has not ever obeyed the gospel and you would like to be immersed into water tonight to have your sins forgiven. We would be overjoyed. The angels in heaven would rejoice. And you know, The Bible also says that there will be rejoicing in the presence of the angels. Now, that means God himself is going to be rejoicing. That's in Luke chapter 15. That's the same chapter that talks about the prodigal son. You know, the son who had wandered away from his father and came back home. Everybody in here at some point has been a prodigal. Everybody has wandered away from God at some point. The only question is, have you come back? And if you have not come back, you need to answer his call. The father of the prodigal is waiting for you to come home to him tonight. Will you come as together we stand and sing?